If you could come in and have a seat, we'll get started. For the last session, a couple of years ago, we threatened to have T-shirts made. I survived the think tank. So your survivor is still here on Thursday afternoon. The last category to look at is a health-promoting work environment. And our first speaker is Kevin Dugan. He is the Jean Monnet Professor of European Policy Studies. So please welcome Kevin Dugan.
I think I need to start off by correcting an impression that may have been presented in the program, that I coined the term new capitalism. To protect myself against lawyers and copyright infringement, I can in fact say that it wasn't me. In fact, there was a conference in Paris earlier on this year, chaired by Tony Blair and Nicolas Sarkozy, hosted alongside Angela Merkel, and the topic was new capitalism. Now, it wasn't a launch event for my book. It was evidence of the kind of growing sense in which capitalism as a subject is being interrogated, not just as an economy, not just as a market, but as a system for wealth accumulation and so forth, a much more holistic and societal way of understanding it. In doing that, I also want to bring attention to a question mark, which I put in the title of my book, New Capitalism Question Mark, The Transformation of Work, because I want to, if you like, interrogate the claims made in the guise of new capitalism and subject the evidence that supports this idea of societal transformation to close scrutiny. Many of you will have read and remembered Daniel Bell, who discussed the rise of post-industrial society. And what was interesting about the accounts of Daniel Bell and changes of the time some 40 years ago was the, if you like, the modesty of the tone and the tenor of the judgments made, the analysis and conclusions offered. He was saying, I'm just talking about structural change in society, the rise of the service sector, the decline of rural agriculture and so forth. And he argued against drawing any broader sociological inferences from it. He argued against people like Frank Matlock, who championed, was the first to come up with this idea of the knowledge economy. And Bell, based upon the evidence, he said you cannot really premise societal transformation on this basis. So we see here kind of Daniel Bell's empirically tested and fairly modest and tempered analysis of social change. Against the time, people like Toffler, who wrote about future shock and embraced social change with a kind of heroism that is, you know, difficult to imagine. Imagining the period that they were going through at the time was equivalent and more far-reaching than any form of transformation in the history of human society. Not since the transition from hunter-gatherer society, those sorts of profound changes in society were captured in Future Shock. So you see a conceptual spectrum between those who offer tempered, empirically analyzed changes versus those who make the huge, claims, heroic statements about the nature of the period that we're living in. Now, in today's commentaries about the world, the balance has shifted towards more Toffler-like proclamations about the nature of the change, and that's why people are now talking about new capitalism and societal transformation. And so that's why I wanted to interrogate it and to say that the transformation of work is central to those claims. The transformation of work and labour market change is symptomatic of broader societal transformation. The outcome of this is a set of new employment relations, the argument goes. The labour market is a mechanism through which globalisation and technological change in corporate restructuring is expressed generating qualitatively new sets of employment relations. It is said that capital now operates in global markets, is footloose, spatially indifferent, disembedded, unattached to locality. And as a consequence of this, it is said that there are new forms of engagement between capital and labour that are now transient and precarious and contingent and so forth. The luminaries of contemporary social science, people like Castells, Richard Sennett and so forth, describe a really profound shift in the nature of work and employment relations. So Castells, he doesn't use the term new capitalism, he talks about network society. But Castells says that we are witnessing the end of salaried employment. Richard Sennett talks about that modern institutional restructuring has accompanied short-term episodic and contract labour. Ulrich Beck, another one of the luminaries of social science, talks about the Brazilianization of the West. We have the idea of the end of jobs for life, writ large, ubiquitous in its and the assumptions and understanding people have of it. So this means that we're witnessing the demise of traditional employment patterns, traditional labour markets, based upon full-time permanent jobs. Permanent jobs for life, the New York Times said, are as rare as tail fins and soda jerks. Jobs for life, an idea that rungs off the lips of careers counsellors, not just board members, but across the piece. It is a broadly accepted idea and backed up by claims, like in 1993, the New York Times ran with an argument which said, Manpower Incorporated, the temporary employment agency, is the largest employer in America. The story was taken up by Forbes next year, and then by people like Tom Peters, who cycled and recycled the story about this enormous employer we have in the American labor force. According to this, the bonds of reciprocity between employers and workers have been frayed and rendered tenuous. People like Zygmunt Bauman talk about we now live in a much more individualized society as a consequence of that. Workers in the developed world compete with the Chinese, the Indians, and Mexicans, and so forth. Now, the evidence points to a substantial gap between public perception and empirical or material reality. And it's important not only that we recognize this gap, but we try and explain it at the same time. Now, I'm talking about evidence up until the current economic crisis, say in the middle of 2008. But the evidence across the OECD countries is pretty convincing that job stability has not declined. Long-term employment measured by those in work for 10 years or more has increased by and large across the piece. Short-term employment is declining in many, many sectors. And this argument about contingency and precariousness and the growth of temporary, this argument about Manpower Incorporated being the largest employer in America is just plain nonsense. It's employment agencies look at payroll figures, present payroll figures for a whole year. And that's why for a whole year there's 600,000 placements. And that justifies the largest employer tag, but in reality, Manpower Incorporated employs about 80 to 100,000. In fact, temporary employment agencies in America, where the specter of contingency and temporariness and precariousness is very, very strong, temporary employment agencies account for 1% of the workforce. And yet there's this enormous intellectual edifice built around this idea of temporariness. Part of the way of understanding this gulf between public perceptions and the material or empirical reality, I venture in the book, is to understand that there is a mode of representation within contemporary or neoliberal capitalism which has a specific way or specific discourse to represent a new virtual, ethereal, weightless world. Previous places of development had a very strong mechanical and material symbolism in railroads, cars, planes, steam engines, and so forth. Nowadays, the imaginary landscape of the new economy, of new capitalism, is captured in ethereal, virtual weightlessness. It is abstract. It is immaterial. And my conclusion from this is that it systematically overstates the mobility of capital and the impact and significance of technological change. Systematically, this is the consequence of a dematerialized understanding of society. Let me talk in the 4.59 minutes of my time left to look at global capital flows, because I said they are central to the idea of the changing nature of work, the competition between the advanced economies and the less advanced economies, and so forth. The idea of globalization is premised upon the idea of planetary flows. And that, in some ways, nothing could be further from the truth. Because if you look at global flows of capital, you see that they are overwhelmingly directed. Patterns and flows of foreign direct investment are overwhelmingly directed towards the rich countries. The idea that the developed economies compete with the less developed economies based upon cheap labour advantage has to reckon with the fact that what motivates capital moving into a small number of advanced economies is market access and less about exploiting cheap labour. In fact, if you look at 2005, I mean, people knew about, you know, this idea of the triad economies dominating the share of global capital, but there are five countries, like the UK and the US, account for 30% of global FDI inflows. Three more countries, Canada, France, and Netherlands, dominate the pattern and flow of global direct investment. This is why the term globalization has at its heart, I feel like, a really profound irony. And that at the other end of the global spectrum, if you look at the poorest countries of the world, they are bypassed. There's whole swathes of the economy. There are 50 countries ranked in the poorest in the world who combined receive less than 1% of global FDI. Transnationality. Let's go back for a second to that. Another concept about global capital flows and the role of multinational corporations, based upon this idea that supports this idea of new employment relations, is that they lack attachment to locality. They're spatially indifferent and can up sticks with all the facility of a travelling circus. Now, the transnationality of the top 100 non-financial corporations in the world have been assessed by UNCTAD, the UN Committee on Trade and Development. And what's surprising about these top 100 companies over the last, say, 10 or 15 years is that their transnationality index, meaning the ratio of what they do at home to what they do abroad, is 50% on average. Now, I want to show you a figure, and it's, for me, in terms of research for this book, one of the most amazing figures I came across, statistics came across, about America. Because in America, the competition engineered between Chinese, Indian, Mexican workers and US workers is really quite intense and extraordinary. And it's a very pervasive idea that jobs are not just, you know, there's not just employment decline in America, there is job loss and jobs go abroad. This idea of fruitless capital in America looks at the domestic and overseas operations of US multinationals between the 77 and 2006. What it shows, looking at the domestic and, if you like, the parent share and the overseas share of employment and sales through 30 years of corporate globalization, is that the ratio of what capital does and US multinationals do in the domestic economy and overseas has not changed. The balance has hardly shifted. Less than a minute to get through some concluding comments. New patterns of employment have not led to instability, have not led to temporariness, have in fact tended to improve and enhance job retention. Particularly, the rise of part-time employment for women has expanded the long service workforce. But as I said, we have to grasp the gulf between public perception and materiality. And I'm not saying we dismiss public perception as a myth, because it serves a very important social function. Pierre Bourdieu came up with the idea of precarité as a mode of social control in contemporary neoliberal capitalism, in which insecurities aren't a natural expression of life in this fast-changing world, but we look at a regime of control based upon an amplified and exaggerated sense of instability, temporariness, contingency, and so forth. So it serves class interests, it serves political interests, and if we wanted to, if you like, introduce a more rational understanding of the world, which has been an undergoing project of the last couple of days, then we have to appreciate the gulf and the manufactured component to this uncertainty that we experience. It's not natural, and it's of significance for those who are concerned with health. If you remember Peter Hall's explanation for health effects, the wear and tear of daily life, the fact that insecurity, the lack of control in the workplace, has real immediate health consequences. I think precariousness, not as a natural, but as an ideological and discursive construct, deserves our attention. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, Kevin.